Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors.
Very shortly, we're going to have a poll on the screen, which you we would love you to vote on using your mobile phone. So whilst we would like your mobile phone to be on silent, of course, we would love you if you'd grab your mobile phone now. And very shortly, we're going to tell you the details of a poll that Leon would like to do in just a second. So we'll just get rid of that. If you just want to get your phone ready. Right, here we go. First of all, it said in the introduction that I wrote for you, Leon, that you'd made an annualised return of 16%. I then realised I was looking at the 2015 annualised return, and of course it has gone up, and I think 44% last year, is that right, I think?
Yeah.
He's a fellow of the Institute of Chartered Accountants, Managing Director of Equity Strategies, which is a corporate finance company where he sources acquisitions for firms. And Leon loves companies with quality at a reasonable price. Leon went on to write one of the most popular articles ever on Stockopedia, and then he did an ebook for ShareStock, very kindly detailing how he became an ISA millionaire, offering really humble advice for people who are keen to follow his success. And now, in an exclusive Mellow presentation, we're going to build on that even more. Will you please give a huge hand to Leon Borras?
Okay, so I've got a really ambitious agenda. I've got a poll. There's going to be 12 questions. The first two are just for information and a bit of fun and just get us used to the system. But the conclusions of this poll will hopefully support what I'm going to be saying during my speech. So if you would get your mobile phones out, the first question is quite nosy. It's saying, what's your portfolio worth on a net basis? I can't trace it afterwards, so there's no risk of me knowing the data. And the only person who's likely to see it is the person next to you. Right, okay, we're at 100, so I'm going to start then. Okay, so that's great. What that shows me is that this is a better, a richer audience than the average audience that goes to the UK Investor Show. So well done. And if you can, as quickly as you can, if you can answer this question, you take comfort from other investors you know buying the same shares as you. Okay, we're going to move straight on to the next question. Next question, you get irritated by people with different opinions on subjects you feel you know a lot about. Okay, we're going to go straight on to the next question. You are given a choice. Now think about this for a moment. You're given a choice of £8,000 for certain or an 85% chance of winning £10,000 with a 15% chance of getting absolutely nothing. Which one do you go for? As quick as you can. And don't be influenced by what you're seeing as the voting intentions of the others. Okay, next question. You never find it hard to admit you're wrong. Okay, we're going to go on to the next one. You think about the price you originally paid for a share when deciding whether to sell. Only a few more to go. All right, when holding a losing share, say you're down 35%, are you more likely to sit tight or add and sell more? Okay, next question. The markets are really, really bad. You own two shares. One has gone up 100% and the other is down 50%. Which one are you most inclined to sell? Okay, just three more questions. Right, this time you're asked to choose between losing £8,000 for certain or taking an 85% chance of losing £10,000 with a 15% chance of losing absolutely nothing. Okay, just two more. Do you find it easier to cut a share which is down 10% or a share which is down 50%? Right, we're over 100, so I'm going to move on to the next one. When you pick a winner, do you generally look to sell when it has appreciated by up to 30%? This is the last question. Well, that's encouraging. You got that one right. Right. So I'm going to refer back to this poll during the presentation. Right, here we go. So thanks for that. It took a little bit more time than I hoped. So it might mean that we're going to be squeezed for questions at the end. But I am speaking on the ShareSoc panel later on, and you can catch me around the building as well if you want to speak to me. So what I want to do is focus on the role of money management in investing success. A little bit about me. I'm a chartered accountant. I've got my own corporate finance practice. I've been investing for 35 years, a successful 25-year track record with my ISA, an even more successful track record with my pension since I took it over about 10 years ago, and some very, very good returns, and a style that's evolved from being value-focused originally to quality-focused. The value of my ISA is, at the end of 17, was just approaching 2.9. It's now approaching 3. It's built up in this way. The blocks here in yellow, when I say my ISA, my wife always reminds me it's not your ISA, it's our ISAs. So just to make that absolutely clear. So the yellow represents the maximum amount I could have put into our two ISAs over the years, and it shows the cumulative total there. Well, we didn't always have huge amounts of money. We had school fees, we had a business to invest in, and the actual amount I invested in was significantly lower, although in the last 10 years, I have been able to make the full contribution. Now, had I invested that money into an index tracker, which invested in the FTSE All Share on a total return basis, my ISA, or our ISA, would be worth about $600,000 or $700,000. Essentially, we'd have had about a 7% return on our money. The actual performance has been significantly better than that. And what I want to do is really put to you the kind of, in my view, the two key factors that have given me that success. One of them is money management. And although I didn't have a name for it, it was only after I listened to a friend do a presentation, which actually looked remarkably similar to the presentation I'm going to give you, that I realized that that's actually what I've been doing over the years. So my friend introduced me to a book called The Art of Execution. It's written by a fund manager, Lee Freeman Shaw, and he works for Old Mutuals, and he set up a fund, the European Best Ideas Fund. And his approach was to appoint the best investors in the world and get them to invest in their best ideas, and it included investors such as Crispin Odie. And he allocated between 20 and 150 million pounds to each of these world-class investors, and then he analyzed those results over a seven-year period. Now, this is the book he produced. It may seem quite a dry subject, but actually the book is really easy to read. You're going to read it in a couple of sessions. And in terms of important points per page, it actually ranks really high. You know, if you want a bangs for your buck, this is a great book to get. He investigated the 31,000 or so trades that were done by his 45 elite managers. And he showed that in the majority, they got most of their decisions wrong. And yet, overall, the fund was very, very successful. In fact, let's look at the performance. 49%, i.e. a minority of the investments made, were actually winners. 51% lost money. However, 7% of all the investments lost more than 40%. And that's not bad. That's a pretty good control of losses there. And in fact, only 1% of all the investments lost more than 80%. So clearly the majority of his professional investors understood the need to contain losses. Now, he postulated the question, he sort of said, to be a successful investor, you know how to have to deal with success as well as failure, i.e. what do you do when you're losing and what do you do when you're winning? And he came up with three categories or character types. I think he calls them investor tribes: rabbits, assassins, and hunters. And we're going to address the first category first. That's a rabbit. And of course, we all know that rabbits stare into the headlights. And generally, when confronted with a losing investment, they won't sell or buy more. They will actually do nothing. Now, I don't know whether you guys were telling the truth, but actually, and very encouragingly, the majority of you said that you would actually take some proactive steps and you would either buy more or sell if the share price was significantly down, which is very encouraging. So we're to that extent, we're not rabbits. But I have to say that in the answer and responses to some of the other questions, there's a fair degree of rabbits in the room. Okay, but don't be worried, because that includes, you're in good company. A lot of celebrated Citi and Wall Street investors were also rabbits. In fact, one of them had an investment in Raymarine, which he bought at 427p. He eventually sold it under pressure from Freeman Shaw at a 96% loss. Now, he was offered and encouraged to sell or buy more of those shares throughout the entirety of that decline. But he always came up with an excuse. Oh, the shares are too illiquid to buy anymore. And eventually, as I said, he was forced to sell. So how can we avoid becoming a biased rabbit? Well, the first thing is we've got to avoid the primacy error. This is letting our first impressions dominate about a company. You know, the baby duck syndrome, it's called. Baby duck comes out, whoever it sees first, it falls in love with. The second thing is that we must avoid anchoring on a price. And I'm afraid on this one, 71% of the audience anchored on the price that they originally paid for the stock when they came to subsequently take action on that stock. And actually, when you think about it, the price you originally paid for a share is absolutely irrelevant to the decision you need to make here today. Because ultimately, since you bought that share, there's been a whole lot of new information, both in terms of RNS's releases and investor reactions on the market. And you've got to make your decision based upon the value of that stock on the day and not what you paid for it. Endowment bias, overvaluing what you already own. This is something we're all subject to. Certainly, you know, many of you know I hold a big stake in a company called Bioventix. Yeah, I do think that's great, and I do think it's better than most other shares out there. But I've got to be very conscious that I might be subject to this particular bias. Herding, I'm afraid we got this one completely wrong. This is taking comfort in what other people are doing. And 70% of us in the poll took great comfort if a friend was in a stock. Now, if you've done the work to justify that decision, fine. But how often do we find ourselves following an investor friend into a stock without really doing the fundamental work? And what it means is that we end up being a very weak holder of that stock. As soon as there's a little wobble, we get out. And actually, we may well miss on the bulk of the profits. Ego. I've never been accused of having one. Not wishing to admit we're wrong. And actually, on this one, I have to say the audience did jolly well, I think. I asked it in a very odd way. You never find it hard to admit you're wrong. 65% said no. Actually, I think that means yes. So we got that wrong. We got that wrong. We find it hard to admit we're wrong. Next one, and it's one that we all know very well, confirmation bias. Only seeking out supportive data. And this is relevant to politics, to religion, and to investing. But I have to say that actually, we got this one right. 60% of the people, if I've written it down right, went the right way on this one. No, 70% of the people went the right way on this one. They would seek out other data, even if they didn't like what they were hearing, which is good news. The denomination effect, it's harder to take a big loss than a small loss. And again, the audience got that right. 60% of you found it easier to take a 50% loss on a share than a 10% loss on a share. That's good news. And then finally, I don't know if you can see this gambler on the right-hand side having a successful evening in poker. It's not very sharp, the thing, but... you know, the attitude, the share's gone down a lot. Surely it can't go down anymore. Well, they often do, you know. And but we got that right. 66% of the audience correctly said that they would sell the losing share when offered a choice between selling their winning share, which was up 100%, or a loser, which was down 55%. So beating the inner rabbit. So we've got some work to do as a group of investors, because we're not wholly rabbits, clearly, but we've still clearly got a bit further to go. Always have a plan. Always know what you're going to do if you're confronted with a loss, too often we buy a share and we only think about what could go right. We're like Theresa May at the last election. Did she really think about what she would feel like if she only gained that small majority? I don't think she thought too much about it. She was convinced she was going to win with a massive majority. And often when we invest, we only look at the potential good outcomes and too infrequently look at what could go wrong. Materially adapt, which involves actually taking action if there's a profits warning, deciding whether it's the right time to sell, in my view it usually is, or whether actually on occasion it's right to buy more. And the other way of sort of balancing out your inner rabbit is literally not to go all in at the outset. Put your bets on slowly, particularly if you're worried about valuation risk. And we'll come on to an example of that later on, where if something's in an extreme valuation, it's a great company, maybe just put the money in a quarter at a time. So don't be too hasty to jump in, but my view is do be quite hasty to jump out if there's a problem, or at least make a new decision. And of course, you know, you can still be right and still lose money. The markets can always be wrong for longer than you can remain solvent. And seek out other views. I think that is probably one of the most important things to do. And the great thing with an event like this is that it is an opportunity for investors to get together to discuss different companies and to discuss hopefully their opposing views without taking offense or being annoyed that someone has a different view. Because ultimately, you learn so much more from people who take a different view than those who give you a reassuring, well, well done. I'm always reminded of Dragon's Den when people come up and are quite surprised that their investment idea is terrible because all their friends have said such nice, reassuring things to them and no one's ever said it's a madcap idea even though they've put £500,000 or £1 million into it. And be humble. Be humble. You know, I'm always thinking about whether I've got it wrong. Because in the world of investing, you never know for sure whether you've got it right. It's not a perfect information scenario. You could well have got it wrong, and you've always got to be open to that. And this is a risk I suppose people like me and Paul Scott have, which is that we do sometimes talk about our stock ideas, and maybe it's hard to walk back from that if we've been too public in our position. So that's the rabbit. We've spent quite a lot of time on the rabbit. The next categories we'll go through rather faster. The assassin. Now, the assassin, I suppose, is what I like to believe I am when it comes to dealing with losses, which is to focus an approach which focuses on trying to minimize my losses and run those profits. But it is quite difficult to deal with it. It's plays to a key behavioral bias that we have. And assassins tend to have pretty firm rules about how they will deal with it. The first is to kill losses at between 20 and 33% and to be absolutely ruthless about it. And there is a danger that if you know the stock too well, if you're too close to management, you will find a way of justifying to yourself why it's still okay to keep holding. And actually, more often than not, it's probably just better to stick to a rule and get rid. Now, one thing that Freeman Shaw introduced me to the idea of was thinking about losers over a period of time, rather than, generally the better assassins were those who didn't give too much time to a loss-making share to come good. You know, if you don't want to be in a position that is stagnant for 4 or 5 years and longer. And let's just remind ourselves, this is a chart that I have presented previously, which I always thought was a bit simple, but Freeman Shaw has repeated the same graphic in his book, so that seems good enough to me. And it just reminds us, really, that you know, if you take a 10 or a 20% loss, you've only got to get on your next share an 11%, a 25%, maybe a 50% improvement. And we've all done that. Every single person in this room, I'm pretty sure, will have made profits of at least that on one single share. But how many of you have been able to get a 900% increase in the share price? Not many. Those big opportunities don't come around very often, which is why you've got to cut those losses. Because once you're into the 50, 75, and 90% category, you really aren't going to find it easy to get your money back. So the other thing about assassins, is that they're highly disciplined. The pain of losses outweigh the pleasure of gain. And we got this, I think, pretty wrong because we were offered a chance of taking £8,000 for certain or an 85% chance of winning £10,000 with a 15% chance of getting nothing. So the expected value on that second alternative was £8,500. Now, I can understand why if this was only the only time you're offered this, you might say, I'll take the £8,000 for certain. But if you're biased in your approach and you're always looking to avoid, to be risk averse in that context, even when the odds are in your favor, and you're doing this time and time and time again, eventually you're not going to beat the market. You're going to always be underperforming the market because you're missing out on those positive expected value opportunities. And there will always be those opportunities and you must seize them when they're there. Equally, when we were asked about whether we would take a losing £8,000 for certain or take the risk of getting our money back, guess what we did? 56% of us who were previously risk-averse when the odds were in our favour, suddenly decided they were going to take more risk in order to try and claw back the money they'd already lost, the £8,000. So the expected value of that bet was the £8,000 was the right decision. Better to take that £8,000 loss because your expected value of your decision was going to be a loss of £8,500. And yet 56% of us voted to actually take risk at the wrong time. Now, the assassins, and this is just by way of a sort of casual observation, that where they, 421 of the 1,800 or so investments were sold at a loss of under 10%. But 59% of these went on to make money. So if you set that stop loss too tight, there's a very high risk that you'll be whipsawing and actually losing out, although you will preserve your capital. Right, the final category of tribe that, in terms of dealing with losses, is the hunter. Now, this is something I don't often do, and maybe I should do more of. And it requires a great deal of skill. And this is effectively doubling down, buying more when the share price goes down. Now, most usually, buying more as the share price declines is a guaranteed way of going bust. But if you're very selective, and if you maybe have not fully invested at the outset, but gradually put your money in, there may be buying opportunities when the share price goes lower. And sometimes Freeman Shaw found that people would double or treble the value of their holding to the point where they were still able to make money, even though the share price never got back to the value of their first investment. Now we're going to deal with winning. This is the nice problem to have, isn't it? What am I going to do? I'm sitting on a winning share. And Freeman Shaw identifies two character types, the raider and the connoisseur. Now, the raider, he likes nothing better than taking a profit as soon as practical. They're terrified of getting caught and losing everything and end up leaving countless chests and swag bags of treasure behind completely unnecessarily. It really is a case of a premature evacuation. So 611 stocks, so 60, which represented 66% of all winning stocks, were sold for a gain of less than 20% by this expert group. And of these, 61% carried on going up. So these guys, the raiders, missed out on the big opportunities of making money. And as Freeman Shaw identified, the really successful portfolios all contained one or two really big winners. And these guys, the raiders, denied themselves the opportunity. But I have to say, the last question I asked, 95% of you wouldn't take a 30% profit. You were all prepared to run your profits. So I think we've hopefully, as a group, not got that problem. But certainly we need to get in the habit of thinking about running profits. Sometimes it can be incredibly difficult, not least because there are these various issues. First is pleasure seeking, boredom, frustration. I mean, we all know In fact, we may be that character type ourselves that likes excitement. And it can get very difficult to want to hold on to a position, particularly after a strong run-up when it maybe plateaus out and we get restless and bored and want to move on. But generally speaking, you're giving up the best part of your gains. As we've already touched on, fear is another factor. And that's probably made worse by the internet. You know, I've been discussing Fever Tree with friends, and they are picking up stuff on the internet about all the competition from other premium brands. But having all that information at your fingertips sometimes magnifies the risks that you're actually, or the fears that are actually there, such that the risks seem greater than they really are. Short-termism is another problem, a natural tendency to focus on the short term. And finally, risk aversion, which, I mean, I'm afraid to say we failed absolutely on. We got both questions wrong on that one. And it actually supports the theory, the prospect theory. We were absolutely on line with that. So the danger for anyone with a love child that is a raider and a rabbit is you get this kind of distribution in terms of performance. You end up with a few big losers on the left, lots of small losers, lots of small winners as well, but you never get the big winner. And if your distribution around a normal bell curve is skewed in that way, you're going to lose money, and you're certainly not going to beat the index. And remember, most of the research out there shows that private investors do less well than the market and less well than professional managers. But what I'm saying to you is that you needn't be. We can actually do better. And I've spoken previously on the many, many reasons why we can do better than a fund manager. And I won't go into that today. So let's just recap. Why run our losses up winners, rather? Well, firstly, they have rarity value. I mean, how many stocks have you got in your portfolio that have gone up tenfold or that you've had over your investing careers? So don't just give away a potential winning lottery ticket. You know, when you do get one, you hold on to it and you let it run. Secondly, you can beat your rivals. I mean, if you think about it, if other people get restless and want to sell, then that creates price weaknesses, which allow you to then come back in and buy more of these winning stocks. And then the other thing is the house money effect. This is where those who have had a winner cut that winner, delighted that they've made a profit, and then go on to do other riskier stuff and end up probably losing the money on that subsequent investment rather than sticking to what was the proven success. And as we all know, good things happen to good companies. Winners keep winning. Momentum does persist. And the final point is you can never really predict who is going to be a big winner. So if you find yourself in a big winner, just don't give it up cheaply. Finally, we're going to move on to the connoisseurs. So what does a connoisseur do? A connoisseur might have a load of vintage wines, which he holds for investment. If he has a bad one, he might get rid of it. But he knows that generally the vintage will improve with age. And in order to deal with his desire to have some fun, he will open a bottle or two as he goes along. That's equivalent to top slicing in the investment world. Now, the amazing statistic is that the connoisseurs had the worst hit rate amongst everyone. 60% of their ideas lost money. And yet these were the guys and the girls who made the most money for the Best Ideas Fund, because they rode their winners far beyond most people's comfort zone. And they used top slicing as a way of gaining instant gratification, which I think is really important because it provides a psychological means of continuing to hold on to a successful share, because you know that at least you've parked some of the profits. So what are the characteristics? Well, firstly, most connoisseurs think long term rather than, oh, I might make a quick buck on this share in the next 3 months or 6 months. They generally chose low surprise stocks with predictable earnings, often on high ratings, but often I find the highest ratings are those stocks that have got the greatest potential to surprise and disappoint. So I'm thinking there of blue sky stocks that investors continue to overvalue relative to quality stocks, which actually I think they continue to undervalue. And they always think about the big upside potential. So when I'm in with investor friends and they're saying, look, I reckon we could get another 20% on that particular stock. It's a little bit undervalued. I never get too excited. Firstly, you're going to have to put a lot of hard work and research into the idea anyway. And for a 20% return, it doesn't seem worthwhile. Whereas, you know, I'm always thinking of the next big multi-bagger, not least because the multi-baggers will pay for some of my mistakes. Concentrated portfolios. The position size can be more important than the price. I mean, how often do you think to yourself, oh, that stock now is too expensive. I can't afford to buy it. It was 10p. I've missed it. It's now 15p. And then you've seen it go up to a pound. And I think the best way of dealing with that is if you're really convinced about that stock, just buy a bigger position than you might ordinarily have done. In fact, when you're buying at 15p, you probably know a lot more than you did when you could have bought it at 10p. Maybe in your own mind, the position is actually less risky because news flow has been very positive. And actually, in terms of absolute profit, you can make as much by joining the party late, but coming into it with lots of bottles of champagne. I come in big later on. And to avoid being scared, yes, top slice. We heard from David Streder how he very effectively top slices investments. And he has held on to some incredible winners. I mean, LowQ that morphed into Accesso. He's bought for 20p. I don't know, is it 20, £25 now or something? And he's only been able to hold it all the way through because he has effectively top sliced as he's gone along. Having a high boredom threshold is also very, very important to being a connoisseur. And of course, you need to combine your connoisseuring skills when dealing with a winning stock with either the assassin or the hunter mentality when dealing with a losing stock. So, you know, really, I mean, John Lee talked about successful investing being down to patience and common sense. And I don't disagree with that. And what I'm saying is that another way of spinning it is that success in investment is down to effective money management plus great stock selection. This guy who decided that Boros wasn't a good enough surname for him, so he changed his name to something like Soros, had this to say on the subject. So I've gone through all my stats for the last 25 years, and this is just within my ISA only. I've only made 154 investments, so about six a year on average. And that was from around 400, just over 400 trades. Now, you know, I was embarrassed about this number of winners because I thought it was rather low. But actually, I think on balance, it's not too bad. 60% of my investments have been winners and 40% losers. And I went back through the maths and I thought, surely with all this gray hair and experience, surely my win ratio has improved over the years. But it hasn't. I was doing 60-40 15 years ago, and I'm still doing 60-40. I cannot escape from 60-40. And compared to the professional managers, actually, some of my stats were worse. So almost 9% of my investments lost more than 40%, compared to just 7% for the professional investors. And 1.3% of my investments lost more than 80%. Compared to one for the professional investor. Mine's obviously a much smaller statistical sample than theirs. Now, the key stat I'm coming to is this one. Despite only 60% of my bets being winners, in terms of value, 86% were winners. So when I took the winners by value and I added it to the losses by value, the winners trounced the losses, 86%. And so really the conclusion I came to was that even if my stock picking skills are okay at 60-40, where I've made the difference is in money management. It's cutting those losses, running those winners, and that has allowed me to ensure that overall I've managed to deliver it by value, a huge percentage of winners. And to help me, I've been investing, generally speaking, in the right kind of stock. And I think in terms of stock selection, you've got to start by what's likely to be most successful. And Ed Croft, when he spoke at the UK Investor Show, talked about batting averages, getting yourself into the right kind of stocks that are likely to deliver the right results for you. And again, analyzing my investments by quality, special situation, growth, value, blue sky, and hedges. 88% of my quality bets made money for me. Only 70% of the special situations that I invested in made money. 67% of the growth stocks that I bought made money. I think it drops to 57% for value. Now, where do we think Blue Sky is going to be, higher or lower? You're right. 33% of my Blue Sky bets made money. And I do genuinely believe I did more Blue Sky bets in the early years than in more recent times. But certainly they've been a bit of a disaster. And the hedges I've taken have been a disaster. I mean, 22% of my hedges, which usually takes the form of taking an ETF, particularly when I'm worried about what's happening in the markets, only 22% have made money for me. And what I realized was that I was rubbish at taking profits on those ETFs when the markets were originally going down and those ETFs were in profit. However, it stopped me meddling with my overall portfolio. So in total, hedges have cost me over the 25 years, close to 3% of my return has gone in those losses. But it meant that I was able to be solid through difficult moments in the market. Quality stocks made three times the money that Blue Sky stocks did on average, and two times more than growth stocks made on average. And in both cases, I've excluded my big winner, which was Bioventix, from those stats. And value stocks made more money per investment than growth stocks, but contributed a lower percentage of winners. If you remember, value stocks only delivered me 57% of winners. But I suppose because they were value, by their nature, when I did get it right, they made more profit than the growth stocks. In fact, the growth stocks made up 32% of my selections, but have only generated 24% of my returns. Yet quality has contributed, and this is excluding Bioventix, quality has made up 24% of my total returns, but by number has only made up 16% of my investments. So I created my own bell chart showing my distribution of returns. The two axes aren't quite the same. So on the left-hand side, you've got losses down to £50,000 or £60,000. On the right side, you've got profits. This is per investment. And you can already see that it's heavily skewed to the right. And on that left side, there were 15 investments that made a loss of £10,000 or more. One that made a loss of a bit less than £55,000. Interestingly, the vast bulk of the investments, close to 100, were in that middle category where I either lost 10K or made 10K. All that effort for no real return. So really the big money has been made in this right-hand side. It's what you call a fat tail, and it goes on much longer. Had we done it to scale, it would have been out here compared to the lost side. And there I've had a lot of 44 big winners or winners, including really big six-digit wins on Beazley, Capita, Autonomy, XL Media, Empresaria, and Lloyds Bank. And of course, there were failures. This is a list of my losing investments within my ISA. I've got some other ones to show you if you were interested outside my ISA. And I should say that my ISA only represents part of what I'm investing. So on the you'll see the losses here. And four of those companies from my biggest loss list have subsequently gone into administration. Some of them took their time about them. I mean, Torotrak took 15 years after I sold it to go bust. And Manganese Bronze took 13 years to eventually go bust. But bust they certainly went. And then you've got other ones like Yell and C-Energy. With Yell, had I not cut my loss at 16%, I would have taken £250,000 loss from that rather stupid decision. I'm sure everybody in this room said, what on earth is this guy doing on the stage and admitting to the fact that he was long Yell for a little bit? But it happens. This is a company. I want you to think in your heads what it could be and who it might be. This is based on brokers' forecasts. And this company has had these brokers' forecasts and has consistently over-delivered. And we see the same effect in earnings per share. Original forecasts and then revised forecasts coming in, constantly being uprated. Wow. And look at this company in terms of returns on capital employed. You know, I use this measure called ROTA. I haven't got time to go into it now, but there aren't that many companies that generate a return on tangible assets of that order, around close to 45%. Phenomenal. Who'd like to own this stock? Oh, you just guessed it. It's an amazing one. And of course, the markets know that. It came to market on a PE of 71, and it's consistently had a PE of around 50. Who'd still like to own it? And of course, the company's Fevertree. Now, 4 years ago when I spoke, I gave an idea by Ventix, which is now four bagged since then. And I get a lot of appreciation and thanks from those people who were in the room at that time. I don't know whether in 4 years' time you'll be thanking me for Fevertree, because clearly this stock is priced to perfection. Yet the company itself, in terms of the way it operates and its economic and financial characteristics, is close to perfection as well. This is just showing where its PE was a few days ago at around 60. Now, a friend told me to short this at £6. In fact, quite a few friends told me to short it at £6. I paid no interest because I thought, oh, it's far too expensive. I started to take note at around £11. And you can see I'm a fast mover, because by the time we got to £19, I actually started buying. And I bought twice now at £19 and at £25. And I'm not fully invested yet because I'm worried about the pricing and any setback either in the market generally or with the company. And these are some figures based upon my own projections. So from 18 through to 20, I've extrapolated in my forecasts where I think they're going to be. And these forecasts are way, way above where the market is currently forecasting the stock to be. And we see the same thing in terms of H1 and H2 sales broken down by region. As you can see, the UK back in 16 wasn't that important. It was almost, Europe was almost as important as the UK. They focused on the UK, they've gained great traction and momentum in the UK. And by the end of 17, you can see that UK represented over half of their total sales. And although that will slow inevitably, the fact that they've now taken over their own distribution of their own management of the US should see the US go from 40-odd million sales and increase very significantly. Now, my forecasts assume that growth won't stay at the heady rates they have been of 70%. My forecasts assume that actually the return revenue will grow significantly slower going forward relative to historic. So essentially, revenue will grow in my forecast at 47% compared to 66% last year in 18. In 2019, it will drop to 30, and in 2020, it will drop to 26%. Yet, despite that, EPS, I think, will get close to 90 pence by 2020. Now, there are risks, and I really haven't got time and to go through them all, and if anything, they're far too small. So if the slides are made available by Mello, then you can look at those. But they're all the obvious factors that everyone mentions and that we're all aware of, and in the end, you've got to just take a view. But I think this is a world-class company. So thanks very much. That's the end of the presentation.
Please give a round of applause for Leon Boros.
PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.